Poetic translation for the monolingual, why there are no apes in Bulgaria, and one of many reasons B.P. Nickel was so smart. This talk was originally given at the St. The Rosedale Library as part of Jay Millar's Speakeasy in, I think it was April of 2005. 8 years ago, a close friend of mine suffered a brain injury. As is common with stroke and brain injury patients, he had to relearn language and how to walk and generally care for himself from scratch. English came back to him fairly quickly, only not how it's normally spoken. He's a musician, and almost everything he said was in some sort of musical jargon or metaphor. At first, no one knew what he was talking about, but after spending about 6 hours a day with him for a couple of weeks, I began to be able to translate more or less what he was saying for other people and for myself. For example, "It's time for the orchestra" meant, "Let's go outside." When he said, "Hand is out of tune," he meant he couldn't send the right brain signals to his hand to make it work. And even as his English returned to something close to the pre-accident state, musical terms would still make their way into casual conversation, especially when discussing his injury. For example, I heard him say once, "I had a minor third accident." I became fascinated by this process of translating from English to English and how we do it all the time, for children, for medical and legal jargon, when we're trying to figure out what a lover is really saying during a heated argument, only we do it in a somewhat more subtle way. And at that time, much of my poetry began to focus on the ideas of communication and language. In 2002, a joint project was announced by the Banff Center and FONCA, which is the Mexican Arts Council. It was to be an exchange between 10 Canadians, 5 writers and 5 photographers, and 10 Mexicans, 5 writers and 5 photographers. Translation and collaboration, both loosely defined, were to be central themes. I applied as both photographer and writer and was accepted as a writer. In October of 2002, I went to spend 5 weeks with 19 strangers in Mérida, Yucatán, 4.5 hours west of Cancún in Mexico. The other Canadians were Fred Waugh, Shelley Liddle, José Teodoro, Malia Acker, Richard Bailagéan, Don Gill, Patricia Dedman, Rosalie Favel, and David McMillan. The Canadians were from a broad range of provinces, ages, and levels of their craft. There were very few people of color. Patricia Dedman and Rosalie Favel are First Nations, and Fred Waugh is part Chinese. 2 of us were queer, which I suppose is pretty good, considering it's above the supposed average of 1 in 10. And there was 1 Quebecois. Most people were middle class. The Mexicans were Jorge Lara Rivera, Humberto Suaste, Juan José Rodríguez, Laura Barón, Jimena Berecochea, Salvador Alanis, Eric Gervais, he was French-Mexican, Francisco Magaña, Gerardo Montiel Clint, Andrés Acosta. The Mexican contingent was also mostly middle class. There were no Mayans or other First Nations people present, although most Mexicans are of mixed Spanish and indigenous race. Again, there were 2 queer people. The participants were from all over Mexico, though the majority were from Mexico City. There were no women writers from Mexico and only 2 women photographers involved. I'm telling you these stats because they became incredibly relevant in terms of group dynamics as we proceeded with the project. Once in Mérida, it quickly became evident we were going to have problems. Despite their general generosity and wisdom, the Banff Center and FONCA had failed to hire a translator. And although there were some of us who were bi or trilingual, very few people were. So if we were going to work solely medium to medium with the idea that, for example, a Mexican photo would be translated into English or French by a Canadian writer, language would not have necessarily been a barrier. But what if a Mexican photographer who didn't understand English wanted to translate an English poem? I wouldn't say it's impossible to do that without literally understanding the poem. However, it does create certain barriers. Besides which, no one had considered that the entire notion of collaboration is pretty foreign to most writers and photographers who tend to work alone. Also, most collaborations occurred within the same medium, as people had their art form in common and therefore a common language of sorts. Contrary to their original statements, this is also what the organizers encouraged. Many of our first efforts were not that adventurous, which was partly our own doing and partially the fault of the organizers. Writers were paired up by country and asked to translate each other's work. And this was a great experience for me. Because I read, write, and speak Spanish fairly well, it was fantastic because I was able to actually work on translation. I was paired up with a writer named Jorge Lara Rivera, whose work is quite experimental, so it was a challenge. The only other translation I had done was literal translation in university, which is very different from translating poetry, where elements such as rhythm, rhyme, alliteration, etc. can be very problematic. Nonetheless, our collaborations were overwhelmingly ordinary. There were mostly bad translations by people who didn't understand the language they were translating from, so you didn't get a very accurate impression of people's work unless you happened to be bi- or trilingual, which, as I've mentioned, very few of us were. As the weeks progressed, things became more difficult. The specter of what I like to call cultural translation arose. Certain aspects of Aboriginal or First Nations and queer cultures, not to mention Mexican and Canadian culture, whatever those are, as they related to the work of several artists, were virtually untranslatable. It was especially problematic because there was a great deal of ignorance to wade through, and many painful examples of the colonized having to educate the colonizer. At this difficult time, we'd begun to translate discussions for ourselves, something I do not recommend. There were about four of us who understood at least two out of three languages, and this is when I began to notice that people weren't translating literally, but instead interpreting or summarizing what was being said, often with their own viewpoint inserted. Professional translators are taught to avoid this, but over the weeks I became convinced that it was next to impossible, because we're always interpreting, even if it is, as I previously stated, from English to English. We're always inserting ourselves into things. All of this is to say that the idea of translating within a single language again began to grip my imagination, although I put it in my back pocket at the time. My reason for doing so? I was completely immersed in the drama of the factions and cliques and disagreements that were developing in the group. No matter the language or medium, we were constantly getting our wires crossed. How were we going to discuss serious issues like racism or Mexican-Canadian relations or, God forbid, art, if we couldn't even explain what pollo pibil or poutine were? And that's when I came up with a simple project that would allow me to collaborate with the entire group. I took the idea of the game Broken Telephone, where you whisper something to someone and she or he whispers it to the next person and so on around a circle, and the statement comes back totally garbled and everybody laughs. And I made it into a translation game. I wrote a poem in English about my frustrations with our communication, and I passed it to someone to translate to Spanish or French, who passed it to someone else, and so on. Inspired by my thoughts on the impossibility of accurate translation, I created some rules to allow participants to translate based on overall meaning or rhythm or any way they saw fit. This was also an aid for the monolingual. The project went amazingly well, although it took more than a year to complete. At the end of the 20th poem, I translated the last poem into an image, and I'm trying to pursue this translation of media within the group, but it's very expensive to reproduce photography in a chapbook form, so I haven't completed it yet, although we are still doing a back and forth about it. I did produce a chapbook, however, of Broken Telephone that you can buy if you'd like one. But back to chronology. I left Mexico before Broken Telephone was completed. Over the next year, I emailed participants and managed to get us to the 12th translation. And in September of 2003, the group reconvened at the Banff Center, this time in Alberta, for 6 weeks. Our collaborations, unfortunately, did not do much better than before, although there were a few cross-media projects that resulted in stimulating visual art shows and videos. The organizers and facilitators were all visual artists, so there was a slant in much of our programming towards visual art, and little consideration given to literary issues. I was quite shocked when, as ideas for collaboration, many of the photographers chose to engage us, writers, as models rather than as writers. "Come pose for me" was far more common than "come pose for me." But by October, I finished Broken Telephone and made it into a chapbook. In doing so, I discovered more ways to think about translation. One contributor in particular was instrumental to the birth of Blissful Times. Translation number 5, from Spanish to English, in Broken Telephone, was by Fred Waugh, a Calgarian who didn't understand Spanish. Fred decided to do a sort of sound visual translation mixed with literal translation using a dictionary. A sound visual translation is often called a homolinguistic translation based on what the words look like in English. He translated the title Encuentros, literally meetings or encounters, to Incensed Truth. Encuentros, Incensed Truth. Likewise, Ella espera el dolor y la impaciencia, literally, she awaits, expects, waits for, pain and impatience. Ella espera el dolor y la impaciencia became the sparrow's impasse in silence. Other examples from his poem, the Spanish cruza y no cruza, which means crossed and uncrossed, he translated to crossed but not crossed. Sus piernas, her legs, became suspended. Sus piernas, suspended. Un tañido de flauta, a note or sound from a flute, became a tornado flaunts. Don Gill, a photographer from Lethbridge, did something similar for translation number 8, though he had never seen Fred's version. Each participant only saw the translation directly before their own. Don played with false cognates, which is when a word in another language looks very similar to a word in English, and we assume the meaning is the same. They can even often have pretty exact spelling. For example, Don translated the title El umbral de la puerta, literally the threshold of the door, gate, or entrance, to the umbrella of the gate. El umbral became the umbrella. False cognates can get you into a lot of trouble in Spanish, just as a side note. Estoy excitada does not mean I'm excited exactly. It actually means I'm sexually aroused. And when a person finds that they've said this, when they find that out, one is usually quick to say, estoy embarazada, which unfortunately does not mean I'm embarrassed, but I'm pregnant. But back to the story. I was intrigued by these sound and visual translations, and I talked to Fred Waugh. At some point during our discussions of this practice, he pointed me in the direction of B.P. Nichols' Translating Apollinaire, which was an important piece in the picture forming in my head. But more on that later. Something totally unexpected happened during my Banff experience. Jorge Lara and I, desperate to find some sort of literary event among all the art openings at the Banff Center, found a series of evenings called Vino y Voces, Wine and Voices, which was open to the public as part of a 3-week translators conference. Jorge and I ended up crashing most of the conference, and the participants were very kind to us. We attended lectures on translation and heard translations of work from many countries, sometimes read by the writers themselves. The conference included poets Ludwig Zeller and David Huerta from Mexico, and translators Mark Schaefer from Boston and Natalie Stevens from Toronto, now from Chicago, I believe, as well as Magdalena Levy, who translated Life of Pi by Canadian Yann Martel into Bulgarian. Learning about Bulgarian translation was especially exciting for me. Two things stuck out above all else in Magdalena's lecture. And, of course, this is just a layperson's understanding of this because translation is new to me. So I apologize to Magdalena if I've misunderstood, but this is what I got from it. That, first of all, in Bulgarian literature, repeating words is considered bad writing. So even he said, she said dialogue requires avoiding constant repetition of he and she, or of the characters' names. The second thing is that footnotes are very common in Bulgarian writing. And the reasons that Magdalena Levy gave for this included style and the isolation of Bulgaria from much of world culture, which necessitates explanations for certain concepts and words. These two facets of Bulgarian writing were especially problematic when translating Martel, as far as I understand it, principally because he expressly disallows footnotes in translations of his work, and also because Life of Pi deals with many creatures and foods that are not known to Bulgarians. So I'm going to quickly illustrate these two concepts with two stanzas from a poem I wrote after Magdalena's lecture. This is from my book, Proof of a Tongue, and it's called In the Details. 1. In Russian and Bulgarian, the repetition of words is considered sloppy. You could never say, I saw Frank last week. After I said hello to him, he accidentally stepped on my foot. All week I've had a swollen foot because of Frank. You'd have to say something like, I saw Frank last week. After I said hello to this man who is my old friend, the tall male accidentally stepped on one foot that is mine. All the past 7 days I've had a swollen little part of my leg because of the guy I met when we were both considering suicide. I wish I spoke Russian or Bulgarian. How else would I ever know you were sad? 2. In Bulgarian, there is no word for ape. Ape is a monkey who looks like a man. So you could never say, a monkey met an ape, or a man met an ape. This loophole benefits the apes greatly, because if they never meet any men, they can survive out there in the jungle just a bit longer. So as you can see, Magdalena was forced to be repetitious in order to say ape in Life of Pi, as she was not permitted to use footnotes. For me, all of this related back to the idea earlier mentioned of cultural translation, and I put it in my other back pocket. Ironically, my perhaps most collaborative multimedia and translation-based project came out of the Translators Conference instead of the program I was actually in. And that project was started by Mark Schaefer, a translator from Boston. Mark took words in Spanish from poetry by David Huerta of Mexico and wrote them on leaf-shaped pieces of paper that he then suspended from branches of a tree in front of Lloyd Hall at the Banff Center. It was really quite beautiful to behold, and you can have a look at it here. The word hoja in Spanish translates as both a leaf from a tree and a sheet of paper. There's a link on this site to Mark Schaefer's website where you can see just how beautiful this project was. I went to the tree, I saw these things hanging there, and I was like, wow, what is this? And I searched the tree for all of the words that I could find. Then I created a bilingual poem out of them, the process of finding them, and my interaction with the tree and the wind as I searched for them. Mark added the English translations of the words to the tree later, as well as tying my poem to the tree trunk. The installation was photographed during several stages of its development and disintegration by many people, including Mexican photographer Humberto Suaste. And what had been created truly evoked the essence or spirit of David Huerta's work, and it really was this physical manifestation of his poetry. So I took this idea into my reading of B.P. Nichols translating Apollinaire. What Nichol did was translate a poem he wrote from English to English, ranging from alphabetizing the words in the poem to putting all the letters in the poem into alphabetical order to even more abstract ideas like walking west along the southern border looking north. In his Interontoduction in 1978, the project was begun in 1975, Nichol stated, in my mind was the idea of a pure bit of research, one in which the creativity would be entirely at the level of the research, of formal inventiveness, and not at the level of content per se, i.e. I recalled the first poem I had ever published, translating Apollinaire, in Bill Bissett's Blue Ointment magazine circa 1964, and decided to put that poem through as many transformation processes as I and other people could think of. I conceived of it as an open-ended, probably unpublishable in its entirety, piece. At the time, Nichol was working on a translation of Apollinaire's Zone, from which he took one line for his poem, Soleil Coupé. And the first translation that Nichol wrote was what he called a memory translation, Order of Recall, and he simply tried to remember that poem that he published 12 years earlier. You can find Translating Apollinaire, sections of it online, and also I think you can get some rare copies of a printed version of it if you search around. It's really worth having a look at. And he played with homolinguistic translation, like we talked about before, Icarus, which was an image that came out quite a few times in the poem, became hick or ass, and a lot of fun things like that. And some of his poems were really abstract, and many were difficult to read aloud, which I think was why he considered the project unpublishable, perhaps. But it really I found it really engaging, and it really sparked a lot of things in my imagination. So with this inspiration, and my earlier thoughts on translating from English to English, and the idea of cultural translation, and finally, with the idea of an essence of a work, I came up with my first pieces for my own project, Blissful Times. Unlike Nickel, I really was interested, or really am interested, in content as well as form, although I would say the content of many of Nickel's translations is incredibly rich. And I'm also more concerned with the general idea of meaning. Also, unlike Nickel, I decided to start the process with someone else's work rather than my own. I took some of the some lines from the character of Winnie in the play Happy Days by Samuel Beckett, and I translated them, or transcribed them, or manipulated them into a poem. I don't know if you can hear that thunder, but there's some serious thunder going on out there while I'm talking to you. So I did that, and the play, if you're not familiar with it, it's Winnie is giving monologue after monologue, talking to her husband, who may or may not be listening, as she's buried to her waist in sand, and then the second act of the play, she's buried to her neck as she talks on and on about existence and many other things. So the imagery of the play as well comes into what I'm doing with my work with it, which is why I do mention that at this point. But my reasons for using something by Samuel Beckett, or for using something by someone else, is that I wanted to trace the writer or Beckett's presence throughout the translations, how much of him remains. Beckett has a really big presence, so I thought he was a good choice. He also worked in translation, and as I learned after giving this talk, he translated Apollinaire's Zone. And secondly, I wanted to trace my own presence in the translations. How much consciously or unconsciously am I changing things according to how I interpret the world based on my particular cultural identities and experiences? And what is personal, what is universal? So I began the project using some of Nickel's ideas, plus many specialty dictionaries, for example, a dictionary of slang, replacing each word with its slang meaning, or a dictionary of clichés, replacing each word in the poem with a cliché starting with that word, and also with other ideas I've come up with. Having access to technology and software has given me an extra element to the work. For example, google.ca has allowed for some fascinating translations, as have some language translations I had fun with at the beginning, like freetranslation.com. They give you these incredibly garbled translations. It's fascinating. Also, I use voice-activated software, so that has been a really interesting thing to play around with in terms of translating. And so far I've done about 50 translations, and I'm amazed at how much both Beckett and I are present in the content, and I'd venture to say emotional aura or essence of all of the translations. And this is starting to become the main thrust of the project for me, is that despite translation and formalistic constraints, the poet or the poem still comes through. So that's all I have to say to you today. I hope I haven't bored you to death. And check out the rest of this site if you can. Thanks so much for listening. Thanks again to the St. The Rosedale Library, Jay Millar, or Jay Miller, which is really how it's pronounced, but because it's spelled funny, people say Jay Millar, and his speakeasy, and everybody who attended. Thanks so much.